that's the cool part of things that you get to do when you push your own life experiences into the story. You get to stretch it, make it funnier, and then it's not just a reminder that for, you know, 4 years of my life, I was working at a mall. It's instead like, I had that experience. It was what it was, but now I can look back at it and make it into something funny, different, cool, relatable, whatever. But like, it existed. It was just something I could pull from. It's nice.
You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. Before animation, Tanika created platforms to showcase diverse and LGBTQ voices with no limitations to their imagination in comics. One of my personal favorites was Casual Hacks, and Deja Brew was hella good too. Point is, Tanika is an amazing storyteller and changemaker, and you should know who they are. In this episode, we discuss growing up with a medium that has now become their life, how the collaborative process can make your crew feel like a family, how to talk about what you're doing when you can't actually talk about it due to NDAs, and how to improve diversity inclusion initiatives to make real change that lasts more than a year. So grab a beverage of your choice, sketch while you listen if you like, and enjoy.
Hello, everybody. I'm Tanika Stotts. I am the story editor for Pinecone and Pony. And what brings me joy in animation is making my kind of like idols and heroes that I've grown up with say really ridiculous things into microphones and make kids all over the world laugh.
I love that. Do you have any personal like moments from your journey that where you did that you could share?
Absolutely. I love hiring Keith David. He is my favorite actor to work with. Not only that, but he's been an icon since the days of Gargoyles for me. That's a show originally by Greg Weisman that used to come on television in the early 90s. I have since worked with Keith David a few times, including on Craig of the Creek and in another show that will be airing it hopefully soon, but hasn't been confirmed yet.
Oh my gosh, that is so exciting. What a beautiful thing for you. Like, you've grown up with animation, and to get this, you know, opportunity to do such a thing is just a delight to hear. What was it that originally inspired you to pursue animation? Like, when did you realize it was a job?
I never realized it was a job. I apologize deeply, but even though I am a kid of the 90s, the 80s, and then some, I didn't actually know this was a field. When you were having like career days back in our middle schools and such, it was, hey kids, come learn how to be a AM DJ, FFM, you know, kind of style. There wasn't anyone who came in and was like, hey, did you know you could write for cartoons? I thought it was always the actual artists who made the cartoons who are actually writing all the dialogue. I didn't actually have that full understanding of the written side until I was actually approached by Rebecca Sugar personally. And that's kind of what got not only my start in animation, but led me to where I am today.
That's so wild.
I know, it's like, how did you not know, you dink-donk? But here's the truth. I did not really know. I had not even considered it as a career. When you think about it, this isn't really an industry that kind of verbally opens itself in that way. Mm-hmm. Screenwriting is usually what's attributed to just like live action. I feel like animation has really kind of opened that door within the last maybe 5 years to the last decade, but it wasn't something I felt was prevalent, especially in disenfranchised and marginalized communities. It's like, we know that these things exist, but they're not geared or openly promoted towards us. And even when they were finally geared towards us, it took a really tragic event for people to be like, oh, I guess we should have these other voices in the room. And that's not really a great place to start on their side either.
No, it's so many people were woken up like, oh, racism does exist.
Like, yeah, no way. Wow, look at what we've been not creating for, you know, to stop this kind of radicalization that's formed. And, you know, the destruction of even environmentalism statements within cartoons, like things like Captain Planet. You can't really point to anything that is as poignant or as really just like as blunt as we were in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of going back to one of your points about like you thought that story, like the artist wrote the shows, like that is where it started, right? Like yeah. It wasn't until this like negotiation round that animation writers actually got their own classification apart from story persons. So that makes sense that you would think that.
Yes. I grew up in the world of Looney Tunes and Hot Stuff and Chilly Willy the Penguin. I come from a world where, you know, I obviously know that there are writers, but for me, those writers more existed in anime. The kind of like roles of women creating not only badass characters, but also being able to tell stories that really appreciated gender and took different ideals of just like modernization. That came more of the influence from Japan, and I didn't really feel like I could get a job there as easily without really knowing Japanese, which is why I took courses, and I did eventually get to go to Japan, but still, it didn't click for me even then that this was something I could do. Instead, I was just a writer of comics because I was a deep fan of manga.
Yeah, it's really cool that while you didn't see animation as an opportunity or a route, you did see comics. Like, so when did you start getting into like creating comics?
Wow. For a very long time. I have quite a storied history as far as comics are concerned. Nothing really awful or anything like that, except for a few wild incidents that unfortunately happened through comics. But here's the gist of it. I've been wanting to make comics since the early 2000s. And I had the opportunity. I started actually with an artist from Indonesia for a cool website back in the day called Manga Magazine. And then that rolled into, after that kind of like just stopped, right? Because the artist finished the comic. I then moved into a webcomic of my own, actually with my partner. She started doing the art for it, and we called it Grand Grimoire. And it was a story about a book about a book about a book. I wanted to do one of those heavy, metaphorical, hardcore magnum opus stories, which you should never, ever start with. But it was something that was born just from my love of the imagination, the ingenuity, and just the collaboration that comes from comics. I've worked in both music and in spoken word beforehand. So coming into comics, I was just finding how you put collaboration and also how you put understanding of not only working with another person, but how their vibe flows with the work and how that makes for a good story.
Do you feel like having written and collaborated in comics kind of set you up better for when you went into animation?
Absolutely. I would say 1,000%. I absolutely love the experience that I got in comics. I absolutely love the friends that I still have from comics. I even, when I got here, I started printing comics for a storyboarder by the name of Mira Ong Chua, who I had met while working at the Cartoon Network. And it was really wild to me to meet people who worked in animation full time who did not understand that comics not only was a viable field for them and their talents already, but that they could easily print these things on their own because this world makes it a lot easier because we're respected and paid a lot more than we are in comics. Comics is like the bottom of the barrel as far as pay scale, as far as respect scale. There's a lot of clout chasing in certain ways, But here I don't have those same inhibitions, or not inhibitions. I don't have those same restraints. Mm-hmm. And therefore I can be a lot freer here in animation, and I'm working with a lot more adults and people who have a whole envision for seeing something come together, while comics can sometimes be a solo game or just a click game. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it is a naturally adherent game of, I want to create this thing so that kids or people or adults can enjoy them. But leaving that and then coming here kind of just upped the ante for me as far as, all right, but this will be seen not just by thousands of people, but by millions of people. So I really want to make sure that no matter where I'm coming from, that I have the right people, because I'm not a credit hog, that I have the right people getting not only their due, but they are on board for the project as well. And they have the same heart and understanding of what the outcome is going to be.
Hmm. I love that. I've always loved when you tweet about your process in particular, where like, or maybe this was in another interview somewhere that I heard you say this, where like when you're writing, because like we write for a visual medium, right? We know that the artists are going to revisualize what we've written. And while it has to be clear and stepped out, like for big action sequence, et cetera, you also like, you leave room for them to put what they think is best. Like you, I think you said you leave like a little note for them. And I haven't seen that on a lot of shows I've worked on.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear more about that, where like you're inputting the collaborative process into your script.
So I hadn't seen it in previous scripts that I had worked on in either children's or adults. But I had to be very clear with my colleagues and those in the writer's room. We are not the end-all and be-all of stage direction, just like we aren't in a play, just like we aren't in live action. In animation, our peers, they have a fully corporalized idea of how this will come to frame through the screen. And since we are not writing those stage actions, you have to let go. And you have to understand that our scripts don't need to be 17 pages and some change for 11 minutes. They only really need to be about 12.
It is way too long.
There doesn't need to be this flush of dialogue. You really need to allow the zoink and the zonk to exist, which is, you know, where you get that true stretch, where someone sees that joke you've just landed and they make it even funnier because they're adding that visual element to it. That acuity and understanding that part of the process and the collaboration is really necessary, because why would we demean someone whose literal job is art? We as the writers are also creating our own form of art, but there needs to be some sort of balance. There needs to be an understanding that we are not a voice of God when we are creating these works. We are part of a machine, a healthy machine, that when every part is moving in synchronicity, it is going to make that end result not only beautiful and fluid and seamless, but it's an understanding that we're all trying to do this right from the same side. Sometimes you have artists who really want to drop that ball. Sometimes you have artists who make absolute touchdowns with it. It's the same on both sides. Writers do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So we're only human.
We're all only humans. But all of our work goes into machines, computers, you know? So we have to catch those little minutia points, and also remember that the person on the other side receiving this is also a human, and therefore we should respect them like one.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. And like, yeah, our scripts are not the art. It is to aid the ultimate art process of the final animation. I love the collaborativeness of this industry and of the product, like the product we make, which is the episode and the show, etc. So like having like a full vision, like, because I feel like as a writer or an artist, like whatever your role in it is, you have to have a vision within the vision of like your director and then your EP, etc. How do you kind of see your influence within your role? And I'm kind of referencing your time now on Pinecone and Pony, where you actually had a lot of influence over like the diversity of the cast and the array of body types shown on screen.
For Pinecone and Pony, I want to give a lot of credit to Victoria Evans, who was our lead character designer, Laura Bufano, who was our art director, and then Wayne Michael Lee, who was our director. Pinecone and Pony isn't just me saying, hey, we need to see bodies of this type, this type, this type. It was actually a collaboration of sitting down with the people involved, including Stephanie Kalner, Kate Beaton, and our other executives and producers, and starting them with, hey, have you seen this on TV yet? No, why haven't we? Why have we based our shapes to just one form? Why have we also based our shapes on, and this is how I like broke it down in a really childish way for everyone to understand. I was like, why would I want to see a rectangle with a square? And that's the only representation that I get of body types. Why can't I see a square with a square? Why can't I see a rectangle with a rectangle? Why can't I see a triangle with a trapezoid? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm bringing my own humor into it, but at the same time, I'm trying to explain to them that the diversity of these shapes matter to children. It's not just an experience of seeing an example of this is stretch and this is, you know, this is squash, right? It's giving them more to digest for their eyes. It's making a full palatable experience by playing with those shapes and giving diversity, not just to the forward shapes that they're seeing, but to the show in general. And it was actually through that conversation that we began to break free of a lot of molds. And that included with our non-binary character, Ren, and their partner, Gladys. That was when that conversation for me really came forward in a very strong way, mostly because I wanted to explain to people that I was tired of seeing the representation, especially of brown love or queer love, shown through these examples of it can only be black and white, or it can only be this thin person and this very large or muscular person. I wanted to see a larger person with a muscular person, hence Gladys and Ren, hence how we wanted to not only give different forms of representation, but allow them a space to breathe.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's such a wonderful thing that you all have done with the show. I think the first time I ever saw like a variety of body types with Steven Universe, to be honest.
Yes.
And I think I would have just been like so giddy as a kid to see that on screen. Because it's always like these like girls with like very thin legs, you know, running around on screen with blonde hair usually, or red hair. Which I like that part because I have red hair. but it matters to see yourself on screen or someone with the same skin color, same hair color, same body type. Like those things matter. So I love that you guys figured out how to do it. Cause like I've worked in pipelines where it's like, what is the fastest thing we can do? Because this schedule is ridiculous. And so there's a lot of conscious choice being not taken because you're just trying to get the job done. So I feel like the more we have these conversations, the better our work is going to get, for one, and the more powerful it will be.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we even went so far as for characters like Peregrine, we consulted with a Haida artist in an Indigenous Haida artist in Canada by the name of Chris Archer. We wanted to make sure that not only were we giving these kids kind of their full representation, just in body type, but we wanted that to be more complete to who they were and what kind of story we were telling. And also to invite other people along for the journey to give us an eye as to how these characters were coming out and if they approved of what these children looked like, because we were going to be showing them to their children, you know, and hopefully to their children's children, as the show would be something that they would hopefully embrace. So it was really important. And getting to work with Christian Sharp for like Celestia, she's one of our WizKids, being able to use mobility aids and understanding how the mobility works around them was really important. That again is another shape and another size for our artists to then therefore delve into. And it might be something that they haven't before. So we need to make sure that these people are available, not only to provide them with this information, but to make them understanding of why these shapes need to be there and what representation these shapes truly take form well beyond and after we finish the series.
So this, when you were talking, it reminded me of how a lot of shows will like hire a consultant mm-hmm. for like an episode, or, you know, to consult on whatever episodes deal with like their specific, you know, lane, right?
Yes.
And I feel like that's great. But then we also have the situations where, like, they don't get hired on these shows.
Yes.
And they are only getting these consultant fees, which, yes. you know, are lower than actual living wages that you would get on staff, right? So, like, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, like, yes, diversity, but then not hiring them full time to actually create the art.
Okay. So, this is going to sound weird. I have I was hired as a consultant and then given a staff writer job.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And I was given actually a full consultant's fee by Hasbro when I was hired for Magic the Gathering, which is with Jeff Klein and Steve Melching. I was actually originally approached as a queer and diversity consultant that they were looking to hire because I had an understanding of animation, obviously. But they really enjoyed my feedback so much, they actually offered me a script and then made me into a full staff writer for the show as well. And that's not saying that it doesn't happen, but I just wanted to let you know about that.
Oh, no, that's such a success story. I love it.
Just to let you know that conversation might be changing, because we had those conversations with our consultants and where they saw themselves in the process and how we wanted to make sure that they not only felt heard, but they also felt seen, which is not only why I know their names and who I've worked with, but it's the process of truly honoring the people who are a part of that process, right? Not everybody we consult with knows how to write for television. That's okay. But there are some who absolutely do. And I call this credit hogging. I don't want to ever credit hog. I wouldn't mind if my name was actually included with my consultants. But instead, they're added to a different title card, which then lists them as the consultant and gives them their due credit. Now, does it have to end there? No, which is why I was very thankful on Magic when I got to be moved into a writer's role as well. But I did have the experience before being thrust into it. And I did have a serious conversation with Jeff at one point where if I had taken on this episode and it sucked, Steve would have just rewritten it. And we do know that to be true as story editors and as showrunners, that, you know, it is kind of a different dance and a special language once it starts going into script. But we as the story editors should be there and be ready to help adjust it in any way, shape, or form so that it can go to its final form of that record draft that, you know, everybody's now working off of. So yeah, I had a lot of, we had, how many, 4 or 5 consultants for Pinecone and Pony. Even though I am queer myself, I am not the monolith. I am not the pinnacle of queerness. There are things about the queer experience that even I'm still learning about to this day. That's because this is my community and I love learning these things. But I got to work with, Liz Brine and T. Ray Eccles from Apple Cares and Apple Pride. And that was even better of an experience. You know, Apple is actually pushing forward and saying, no, you don't have to be the singular voice of this entire instrumentation to make an episode. We will give you the extra voices that you need so that you don't feel insecure, so that you don't feel like you were pretty much pulling a Sisyphus, right? Who wants to do that? No one. Also, that rock is heavy. So being able to include these people and being able to include their experiences is part of our writing journey and part of what we should be doing. But I was just as blunt with everyone else when I said, I do not care if they get a written by credit on these things. That is the conversation many writers should be considering. Many showrunners should be considering. Who does get the credit for these full-fledged episodes? And how can we kind of better our system so that it doesn't feel like we're tearing everyone off into some weird hierarchy?
Yeah, I feel like there are writers, probably just any creative, who like hold their art so tightly where it's like they are the final say of how, and like ultimately someone has to make final decision if like you come up against, you know, disagreements and all that. But like you, like, it feels like your process is very open and fluid, which is so lovely to hear about. I guess I'm wondering how it has been, like, if you've come up against those types who are a lot more like, there's a hierarchy, there's a process, and you're like this disruptor coming in.
I have. I could tell it made them very uncomfortable. I felt like they were trying to make a point out of me being in the room at a few points by rewriting my scripts on the big screen in front of all the other writers. And I think they were trying to impart a message upon me that I'm supposed to be this end-all be-all of kind of people, or that my spelling is absolutely perfect and everything. But you know what? At the end of the day, I just saw for their insecurities coming out, and I saw for the truth of who they were inside, and they didn't really like my vision, and that led to, you know, a little bit of discontent, and it led to us not being friends. And you know what? That's okay. I don't work with that person anymore. But the problem is, but I won't disparage that person. You know, I'm not going to go forward and say that this was the only experience I've had in a negative form. It unfortunately is not. It comes with, you know, a clash of egos, a mix of imagination. And my understanding is I haven't been here that long, so I allow seniority to be seniority. I give it that respect. I come from a family where it's basically born from a lot of military folks. So I do have an understanding of respect that is a little bit different from other people. But at the same time, I am not here to be someone's emotional punching bag. So they can get away with as much as they get away with. But at the end of the day, I don't have to see them anymore. And that's really great.
Yeah.
We just didn't get along in the collaborative process.
Yeah, it'll always be waiting for us around some bend, for sure. Like, do you feel like, because we all have egos, right? Some of us just have better monitoring of it than others. But like, was there a process of kind of embracing your ego at all? Because I feel like, especially, you know, women and marginalized people may be like more worry about how they present in the world more so than like other people with more privilege, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of wondering how you came to just embrace it.
I think I came to embrace it actually, and this is going to go a lot back further in my career. When I was a slam poet, I was, aged 18 through 22, I believe, or so. I had looked in my newspaper. Yeah, not on my phone, guys. They weren't that cool yet. I was looking in my newspaper. I had watched this incredible movie called Slam. It featured this incredible poet by the name of Saul Stacey Williams. And I was so blown away by how powerful this movie was. I wanted to learn more about slam poetry. And so I went to this little place. It was called the Ascenza Coffee House in Mesa, Arizona. And from there, not only did I learn about a multitude of different voices, and I mean a multitude, you know, we had teams that went to nationals. I got to hear and learn many voices and see many stories and realize that my life experience wasn't as big or as great as I thought it was at 18. In fact, in truth, I wasn't an adult yet. I was just starting. I was still just a fledgling little kid who was realizing the power of my voice. And through that time in slam poetry, I got to learn who I was. I got to perform therapy in a way, because my life is not like anyone else's, and their life is not mine. but we do have some shared or relatable interests, such as I come from a home of domestic violence, right? That's not something that everybody shares all the time. I came from a home where I was born in an area that was pretty violent, or it didn't have great social standings at the time, and it needed to work those things out. Does that place look the same as when I was born? No. So again, I don't disparage it, but it's a part of me. It's part of my scars. It's part of my flesh. So that ego, you kind of got to leave it at the door, at least in my world, because I'm not the end-all be-all. I don't care about the F word, aka first in doing this, that, or the other. I just want to have fun, which is a completely different F word that a lot of people kind of shield away from their more professional aspects of life. And I'm like, yo, we work in animation. We make things for literal children. If this is not fun, it's kind of torture. And nobody's going to enjoy that.
Yeah. Do you like, because when we write for kids, I feel like a lot of us pull from our own childhoods.
Yes.
So like, because I also have some dark things in my childhood, yes, where it's like I go to dark places when I'm writing, yeah, but then I have to find the hope,
yes,
and focus on that and find the fun while still making a nod towards the hard parts of a kid's life. So like, how is your process when you're writing an episode based on like your childhood or a feeling or whatever it is that inspires you?
I just like to get the heart of the story across, right? The heart beats is what I like to call it, because I know everyone calls it a beat sheet and I think that's yeah, cool, but I like to call it my heartbeat sheet.
I love that.
Because it's like your circadian rhythm, right? You're like, you're going through the emotions. There's a moment where you start and your pulse is fine, and then you get to the action and your pulse gets erratic, and then past that erratic pulse, you know, there's the cool down factor. But what if you stay at a high the whole time, right? That's not really a story. That's just tension the whole way through. No one feels comfortable that way. So, you know, you kind of got to pulse it out like a heartbeat and give it those moments and that time to breathe and relax. I also like to, you know, bring in my own experiences. I worked on a show where I was sitting in a meeting and we were talking about a mall, and I was like, yeah, hey, there's a trash compactor in the back. Did y'all know that? And they were like, no. And I was like, did none of y'all ever work in a mall? And none of them had. And that's not a disparage to my coworkers, but it just shows me the differences of their life experiences too. So I got to share not only an experience with them, but it also went into my episode, and it was very fun because once they knew that trash compactor was there, we then also lit it on fire. Because that's the cool part of things that you get to do when you push your own life experiences into the story. You get to stretch it, make it funnier, and then it's not just a reminder that for, you know, 4 years of my life I was working at a mall. it's instead like, I had that experience, it was what it was, but now I can look back at it and make it into something funny, different, cool, relatable, whatever. But like, it existed, it was just something I could pull from. It's nice.
Mm-hmm. That's why detours, like, I hope that people can make peace with their detours before, yeah, getting to their dream jobs, is because, yeah, it really does fuel a lot of things that you can do and talk about and bring to the room. And that's also why we need more people with a variety of experiences, like when you're, mm-hmm, like putting together like the a word is escaping me, but like, I'm going to say the blood work of your room. This is wrong. The DNA of your room is what I meant to say.
No worries.
It's got really macabre. Okay.
It's okay. I went to medical school for a short time before, whoa, getting kicked out. So it's like, but I tried.
You got kicked out.
Yeah, I didn't. Forensics, just not for me. You really have to be ready to handle a lot of bodies. And if you're not ready, you can't do it. And my mom, she was a nurse for 27 years in an ER. I have a lot of stories, including how I learned about sex education from my mother at like age 12 with full charts. My mother didn't want me to be ignorant to this aspect of anatomy in the human body. But like, does every kid get that? No, she just knew that there was a lack of that formalized education in the public space and wanted to make sure that I was aware of it. That is a difference of parenting and teaching. I appreciate her for that, even if I don't appreciate her for many other things I was subjected to throughout the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So again, it's about how you make peace with a lot of the things that were happening to you, but also therapy is really great. So are drugs. So are a lot of things. You have to be able to realize that you can't just self-medicate everything away, and that sometimes you need to find your actual full release. For me, sometimes that's still writing scripts, even including the last one I did for Young Justice. I still get to think of my work as therapy sometimes, not just for myself, but maybe for the viewer as well.
Mm. I feel the same about that with the scripts and processing, and hopefully it gives something to the viewer.
Because
I feel like for me it leads to sometimes some like depressive spirals. So how do you handle, if that is true to you, how do you handle those moments if that happens?
My wife really just said, hey, sweetie, since you left that last job, you've been really depressed. And it's really great to be able to have a partner help and call that out, not gonna lie. But also at the same time, it is true. We do go on ups and downs because we end on the show before the show is over. Mm-hmm. We don't get invited to the rap parties that everybody gets to post pictures of on Instagram sometimes. We don't even get to be anything sometimes as part of the process, other than this episode was written by and a tweet, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's not bad, but also where's the celebration in that? Where is the, we crossed a finish line. It takes 9 months, 9 to 12, sometimes 16, depending on what type of story, if it's animation, 2D, 3D, CGI, or stop motion, to even see our work, you know? So we're just moving on to the next job, but sometimes it's really hard to just go from one brain set to the next, especially if you're working in freelance, especially if you've gone from a staffed room to then freelance or vice versa. I feel that, you know, we have our own complexities of how we mentally compartmentalize that process. And for each of us, it's different. For me, I like to cut off all of my hair when I'm done with a huge project. And I sometimes like to go into the middle of the desert and scream. Like, you know, what do you like to do to kind of like decompress from everything?
I love your answer. That sounds great. I may adapt. The last year was pretty hard. I rolled off of my staff gig and started freelancing. Yeah. But there was a few months between where I definitely, because also I love all my teams that I've worked with, but there are some things that just kind of hang on to you in not a great way. I'm like going through like processing. Working is hard with people, and you do kind of shift certain things about yourself or your process to fit within the structure. Mm-hmm. And it really depends on your team, right? And the mixture, because like there's the process, but then when you put people inside that process and that structure, they influence how it works.
Exactly.
So I feel like I had to undo a lot of things because I kind of lost myself. And it was also a time when I was growing a lot, learning a lot, failing a lot, and making a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
And they saw me at my worst and they saw me at my best, you know, and they saw me at my weirdest probably too. So like, I definitely lost a lot of sleep thinking about all the cringeworthy moments. So that's how my process went. But then I started working and I didn't have as much time to think about it.
Exactly. While we're in the thick of it, we don't really have that moment to kind of sometimes just pause, communicate, and say, oh yeah, I did not agree with that very bad statement someone made. I wish I had said something in that moment, but it wasn't my brain space at the time, right? You can't let those moments happen and then live with that kind of guilt forever. Because we're just people. We live in a moment. And sometimes those moments pass and we didn't do anything in that moment. So for me, I realized that I can only be authentic to me. And that's pretty much it. I can go back and inform that person, hey, I just wanted you to know this, that, or the other didn't really fly with me. But at the end of the day, they are who they are. If they didn't recognize that in the time it took or the time that they made that statement, that it probably wasn't a good statement, that's on them to kind of course correct and learn. And unfortunately, I don't really have time to be that ship or that steward, nor do I want to be that caretaker for them. That is their own mental journey that they are going to have to take. And again, as I said, I only work with them for a certain amount of time. And after that time is over, I don't have to give that much care or concern. And I definitely don't have to give them that much of my heart in the process unless I really want to. And for Pinecone and Pony, I gave them my full heart. That was because everybody who I worked on that show with was 1,000% aces and 1,000% real. And that's just up to the writer and how they're feeling about that time with that show. But don't think that that's the end. It's not. It's just another experience you've now had, which you can therefore then write about again later in a different affect. Or you can take a situation that you had and you don't like how it ended, but you can recreate it with those characters and you can make it end the way that you didn't have it end for yourself in the first place. But those characters can take that lesson and move it on to others so that maybe the next time that situation presents itself, they'll know the exact right thing they want to say.
Yeah, I love when you say that, like, well, I related a lot when you said that some things you don't give your full heart to. Like, you do your best, obviously.
Yeah.
But I've worked with some teams where I'm like, oh, I can't give all of my heart and be real, because it's just going to be thrown back in my face somehow.
Yeah, I'll be absolutely blunt. There are many, like, cis white male rooms that I don't fit in perfectly. I am a Black queer kid who is really freaky about shit, and we may jive really well on, like, maybe anime or something of that sort, but they do not have the same experiences as me, and I don't go to the same country clubs as them. So, you know, it's not saying that we come from different worlds, but we do, and it's okay. Those worlds should exist, but I'm not going to tell stories the way that their brain has been trained to tell stories, because I come from a different background. I come from comics. I'm a college dropout. I do not care about format as hardcore as they do, because as soon as my team gets that script, have you ever seen what a storyboarder does to your script after they get it?
They mark it up.
Yes, exactly. Big time. You know why? Because half the crap you thought of does not work for them. And then it falls upon them to put it into the right order, to give it that life, to give it the fluidity and the animated form that it will finally end in. That is what you need to focus on as a writer if you are in the animated space. And if you're not, and you think of it as, this is my story, this is the only way it could be told, you're horrible and nobody's going to work with you later on in life, and you're going to just be who you are, and there, that's the end of it. I mean, we've seen it happen a ton of times.
Yeah. So one thing about, like, you being in these rooms of majority white male, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but those are the rooms that we need you the most in. Mm-hmm. So, like, how do you show up and try to influence as much as possible when, like, kind of the cards are stacked against you in a way? Like, I know this is probably, like, a poorly spoken question, but, like, I hope the point's there.
No, the point is there. When I'm in these rooms, I come in just as myself. And that's pretty much it. You're getting all of this in a bag of chips. Like, I can't really explain it in any way where it's just like there is one right answer. There isn't, because every room is different for me. Every experience is different. So I just take it day by day and where I'm at. Thankfully, my majority of rooms haven't been white and male, or cis or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I got my start on Steven Universe Future, right? So I've got a really super fun and queer room. I got Jack Pendarvis. I got Kate Sang. But then I have all my boarders. I've got Lamar Abrams. I got Mickey Brewster. You know, I got Amish. I got my people. I got my friends. I want to know about their stories at the lunch table so that I can know what it was like for them as kids and what they feel is also missing so that I can then incorporate that into my story in some way, shape, or form and allow their voice to exist and persist in my script just as the same as mine would. Like, that was a family affair. We were really close because not only were we on the same floor, but our offices were all next to each other in a way. So I made the rounds. I got to know everybody. I wanted to know what was up, where people were from, what they were doing, where they were going, what they were interested in. I've made friends that are still my friends from that show to this day. But I did that with other shows because then I went and I visited all of my friends at Craig of the Creek. I met Jeff Trammell there. I met Tiffany Ford. I met Charmaine V. Like, and then my people from Steven Universe were going over there to Craig of the Creek. Like, Cartoon Network was really intercommunal in that way, right? Mm-hmm. And we had big lunch events and all sorts of other stuff that really brought us out together. And it showed me not only the diversity of the people who worked at the Cartoon Network, but the diversity of what it was we were really putting together. And that was really hardcore for me to see at that start in my career. Mind you, that's also storyboarded shows. So after I left Craig of the Creek, I took 6 months off and I taught myself how to script. And then I got hired for My Little Pony, Pony Life. So it's like, you are the steward kind of your own ship. You need to be able to handle things and weather certain storms. And you have to remember that this world is not completely kind to us sometimes, and that we are going to have many adversities, but we have also our own power and our own voice that we can speak up and tell HR that shit is not kosher, or tell, you know, your executive stuff is not cool. And you need to realize that the threat to your livelihood is not speaking up. The threat to your livelihood is not saying anything at all.
You speak so powerfully. You know that. Like, it's so lovely to listen to, and so exciting and inspiring and empowering. This is part one of two of my interview with Tanika Stotts. So please come back Thursday when the second half drops. Thanks so much for listening. The Ink and Paint Folk podcast is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. Please also check out other great organizations and groups promoting diversity in the industry. Black and Animated, Rise Up Animation, Latinx in Animation, Asian Queens in Animation, and Diverse Toons. This episode was produced by me, with the magic of the internet from beautiful Burbank, California. Music by Grace Tsai and TV's Kyle. Edited by Mae Murphy. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast. Stay colorful.